Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated.
Our final case on today's docket is case number 56510, Holcomb versus Genuine Parts Company. Mr. Cook, this is Paul Cook for the appellant, and Mr. Daniel Posenberg for the respondent. Mr. Cook, you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court, Paul Cook on behalf of appellant and plaintiff, the Holcomb heirs, the Holcomb family. The issue to be presented to this court by this appeal, of course, is causation in an asbestos-related cancer case, and specifically the substantial factor standard, how that standard is going to be applied in a summary judgment context, which is an important factor to remember here, that this court is looking at this as a de novo standard of review. And so we're taking a fresh look at what the motions that were submitted by the defense here. So on that causation question, the courts around the country and certainly in California, the Rutherford decision, which I believe is very instructive on this issue, breaks the causation test into two factors, essentially two separate prongs. And that first prong being the threshold exposure. In other words, an identification of the defendant's asbestos-containing product. So that's prong number one. And then secondly, there is the substantial factor prong of that. And substantial factor is necessarily a question of medical causation. You can't answer the substantial factor causation in an asbestos cancer case without medical testimony. That is exactly how, as I said, the California Supreme Court has addressed it in the Rutherford case, a 1997 case from the Supreme Court of California. And I think it's most succinctly stated by the California Court of Appeal in the Lineweaver case. And this is a case that was cited in plaintiff's briefs, but it bears mentioning here because the court says exactly what I've just set forth, that this is a two-pronged test. So that court instructs that the proper analysis on the causation question is to ask whether the plaintiff has proven exposure to a defendant's product of whatever duration. That's key, of whatever duration. That first prong is any exposure to an asbestos-containing product of the defendant. So that threshold exposure is of whatever duration. And secondly, then to evaluate whether the exposure was a substantial. So that's exactly the analysis that I've set out for the court, what I've set out in the briefs, and what should be followed by this court. Now, in connection with that second prong, that substantial factor prong, Rutherford is very clear that factors to be considered in connection with that medical causation question are that frequency, proximity, and regularity of exposure. That's what a lot of the dispute in this case is about. Where does that frequency, proximity, and regularity come into consideration, and how does the court apply that test? And plaintiffs have never taken the position that frequency, proximity, and regularity aren't to be considered. They are to be considered, but in the proper context, and in the proper context is medical causation. So in this context of the summary judgment motions that were presented by the defense, the question is squarely presented, what is the power of the court? What can the court do with respect to that question of proximity, regularity, and frequency of exposure? Now, of course, on a summary judgment, we're all familiar with that standard that the court can't weigh the facts. And it certainly can't announce any scientific or medical principles without any evidentiary support. So to get to that notion of frequency, proximity, and regularity of exposure, there needs to be some kind of evidentiary scientific support for that.
How much support?
Well, number one, there are ways. I'm not suggesting the court can never get to that question on summary judgment. There are two ways a court could get there. Number one, you could have a motion from the defense presenting that issue, presenting that medical issue, presenting the declarations, and it's done frequently in asbestos litigation, where you have a medical declaration from a doctor retained by the defense saying, assuming there's an exposure here, if there is an exposure to the defense's asbestos-containing products, then that was insubstantial, that was not enough. because these exposures would have been so low that it would not have been capable of causing the plaintiff's mesothelioma. So that's one way the court can reach it. And I do think that there are circumstances where you have a de minimis exposure. You have an exposure that's so brief, so fleeting, that a court could look at that and say, well, you know, really, there's not enough here. You might have a situation where the plaintiff is walking by construction work going on at the site, and he merely takes a breath as joint compound work is being done 20 feet away or something. That could be considered a de minimis exposure that might be appropriate in the given case, in the proper case, for summary adjudication, but that's not this case. This case is a case of substantial exposures. This case is a case in which Randy Holcomb testified from his own direct personal knowledge, identifying the manufacturers of the joint compound products that he used. Okay, so direct evidence exposure. Also, it's a mesothelioma case in which you have, it's undisputed that the levels of asbestos exposure that are necessary to cause mesothelioma are very low, extremely low. And you don't even need to get to the declaration of Edward Holstein, which was submitted by the plaintiffs in the trial court below, to understand that mesothelioma is caused by such low exposures. One case that I think is important on that is the Jones versus John Crane case. Again, that's a California Court of Appeal case applying that Rutherford substantial factor test. And in that case, you had an exposure to gaskets. And the defendant there said, look, the exposure to our gaskets was very low, very small, so low that it could not have caused the plaintiff's lung cancer in that case. What that defendant said is, our exposures are as small as 0.1 to 0.01 fibers per cubic centimeter. What's a cubic centimeter? It's a sugar cube. So that defendant is saying there's one fiber in every 10 sugar cubes of air, and that was insufficient. The court, that's what the defense was arguing, that was insufficient. The court looked at that and said, no, that's not necessarily insufficient. Even if you're comparing that to an ambient exposure, you could have a low-level exposure, like something as low as an ambient exposure, and as an aggregate, as a contributing factor, that could be a substantial contributing factor, and we're not going to go beyond what the California Supreme Court has cautioned, which is against a overzealous application of that substantial factor causation. So we know that those low exposures are sufficient to cause mesothelioma. Now, very quickly, what were the defense motions here? The defense motions, as I said, were not on medical causation. They were on threshold exposure. They were on that threshold question. Kelly Moore, it's undisputed, Kelly Moore's their defense in this summary judgment motion was on the geographic defense. They said, we didn't supply it to Florida, and we didn't supply it to Nevada. There was no contention from Kelly Moore that any of their products were non-asbestos prior to 1978. In 1978, all joint compounds were non-asbestos after that point. But prior to 1978, we have testimony of exposure prior to that time, no non-asbestos-containing products from Kelly Moore. So their threshold argument was, we never supplied to Florida, never supplied to Las Vegas. And the plaintiffs, we introduced the evidence of course you supplied to Las Vegas. Here's your own interrogatories that said the southern part of Nevada was one of your marketing areas. So Kelly Moore abandoned that defense, and essentially that's why the trial court found tribal issues there. The district court said there's tribal issues on threshold exposure. Same thing with respect to Georgia Pacific and Kaiser Gypsum. Now, their defense was on the absence of evidence of exposure to an asbestos-containing product manufactured by that defendant. And they said, well, after 1973, we started introducing some non-asbestos materials. But again, we've pointed out, we have exposures in Florida prior to 1973 at a time when all of your products had asbestos. So again, the district court found that to be tribal issues of fact on that threshold question of exposure. Now, with respect to this question of the substantial, what the court actually ruled on, the district court actually ruled on, was this regularity, frequency, and proximity of exposure, that somehow the plaintiffs didn't have enough evidence on that. Number one, not the grounds of defendant's motions, right? Because as I just explained, all they were arguing about was threshold, that there's no exposure to asbestos products from us. So we proved that that was there. So number one, I urge the court to follow the Rutherford standard and hold that frequency, proximity, and regularity of exposures are medical causation questions. And the absence of medical evidence in this particular motion means that the defense motion on that particular ground, assuming you even get there, because they never moved on that, should have been denied on that ground. Now, the cases that do go to the regularity, frequency, and proximity of exposure, cases from other jurisdictions, there's, you know, several, you know, cases all over the board on this. But the cases that are most persuasive and that should be called followed by this court are the cases that urge and follow a relaxed standard of this frequency, proximity, and regularity when you're talking about a case like this where you have direct evidence. The plaintiff himself is saying, I'm using these products. I sanded the products. I mixed the products. I swept up after the products, and I myself, because of that work, breathed in the asbestos from those products. That's a direct evidence exposure. And it's also a mesothelioma, so again, low levels of exposure. So in that type of case, you automatically have proximity. The plaintiff himself is using the product. So boom, there's your proximity problem. With respect to the frequency, again, the plaintiff here, the testimony is that I've done this many, many times. I was a construction worker, and I did this multiple occasions. So beginning in Florida in 1969, going through up until 73 in Florida, and then continuing after that, within the first 3 years of moving to Nevada, during the time in which these materials contained asbestos. He's talking about frequent repeat exposures. So you have that factor of frequency. There's no case that the defense can cite to that tells you how frequent it has to be. It's simply a factor to be considered. And you have proximity, you have frequency, and you have mesothelioma. So that is why, even if we take a look at frequency, proximity, and regularity without medical evidence, even then you have the evidence here. You have that proximity, you have that frequency. And I just want to dismiss a red herring very quickly, and I'd also like to reserve a little bit of time for...
You have about 2.5 minutes left.
Yeah, I see that. Reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal if I could. To each and every exposure, that's a red herring. No medical opinion is submitted in this case that each and every exposure to a single fiber of asbestos will be a substantial contributing factor. Red herring, not in this case. It's not in Holstein's opinion. It's not... The defense didn't move on medical causation anyway, so why would that be an issue? It is, to be clear, each and every exposure would be sufficient for the threshold exposure. I want to be clear about that. That's when we say each exposure is important. It meets the threshold test. No issue on medical causation there. With respect to the specificity, the defendants argue that there's not enough evidence of specificity, that you haven't identified... Mr. Holcomb did not identify a particular site where he used a particular defendant's product, not the standard. Again, the test that we're looking for is whether or not he was exposed to the asbestos-containing product made by the defendant. Since he talked about joint compounds that were manufactured by these defendants in this time frame, and we have their interrogatories that say there was asbestos in those products, that's your identification of an asbestos product. You don't need further specificity. For a clear articulation of that principle, I would point the court to the Tragarz versus Keene case, T-R-A-G-A-R-Z. That's the case where the court said, no, you don't need specific sites. It's enough that you've identified personal use of that product, and you have enough specificity here to identify the defendant's products. The Lorman and Chavers cases, which are relied on by defendants, They don't necessarily apply here. You have Lorman was an asbestosis case. You need huge exposures to get to asbestosis. It's not a cancer case. The Chavers case, the court looked at that and said, you have a single exposure here. That's sort of a passing exposure. So even if under that frequency test, Chavers doesn't compel supporting the district court's motion here. I'll save whatever time I can for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Olsenberg for the respondent.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Cherry. May it please the court. Dan Polsenberg for the joint compound defendants. This court should affirm the summary judgment in this case because the plaintiff, as to the joint compound defendants, as opposed to the rake manufacturers, was not able to show the threshold level of exposure to these defendants' products that would allow a jury to determine that those products were a substantial factor in the contribution of the decedent's mesothelioma. Let's take this argument and break it down as to the proper legal test and how Judge Herndon applied that to the facts that were presented to him. Counsel comes up here and says that there are two factors, that there's threshold exposure and then medical causation. I don't agree with that. I think the threshold level isn't whether there's any exposure at all. The threshold level is whether there's enough proof of exposure of these defendants' products to say that there could be a substantial factor under legal causation. Essentially, really, that's only one factor. Now, they characterize my position. Their position is there are two factors, threshold exposure, any exposure, and medical causation. They characterize my position as having three prongs, threshold exposure, legal causation, and medical causation. The Chavers case from Arkansas that counsel just mentioned says there are four factors, and I'm sure any lawyer with a half a bit of wit could come up with five or six prongs to this. But I think there's really only one thing we're talking about, and that's causation. Justice Cherry's opinion in Wyeth versus Rowat notices that there's a difference between general causation and specific causation, but he doesn't set them down as two different things. And I'm not setting down legal causation as two different things. They have to show the threshold level of proof of these particular defendants' products to show that there's enough there that they would be a substantial factor.
You don't think they showed enough
to view
it in the light most favorable to the non-moving party in this
No,
case?
Not at all.
And it's not a material issue of fact.
There's not a material issue of fact. And counsel spends part of the brief on what inferences they're entitled to. This isn't that kind of motion for summary judgment. This is a motion for summary judgment that tests whether the sufficiency of the evidence, as the Fourth Circuit called it in Lorman. Is there enough evidence here to go to a jury? And in this case, there isn't. Look at how Judge Herndon characterized the evidence. And it's a fair reading. It's not drawing inferences against the plaintiff at all. In fact, what the district judge said was that Mr. Hallman's testimony was honestly vague. And that's true. He came in and he said that he used quite a number of different products. And the ones he was accustomed to using are the three respondents here in Bondex. I'm not saying that you have to identify a specific work site or a specific job. I understand that's a silly position and I've never taken it. But you do have to identify specifically working on with a specific product. And Mr. Hallman didn't do that. Although he was asked, what did you use in Florida? He said, I'm accustomed to these four products. And asked specifically, did you use Kelly Moore because we didn't sell in Florida? And he said, I don't remember what I used. I'm only telling you what I'm accustomed to. Did you use Bondex? Because Bondex, after 1978, didn't have any asbestos in it. Do you remember using Bondex before 1978? And he says, I'm not telling you what I remembered using. I'm telling you what I'm accustomed to using. So Judge Herndon said that he didn't identify, and the reason why the specific product is important instead of just the manufacturer is, we're dealing here with products, manufacturers who made products that for a time contained asbestos, for a time made products that contained asbestos and didn't contain asbestos, and for another time period made specifically and exclusively a joint compound without asbestos. And Mr. Hallman couldn't say which one of those products he used. And he couldn't say with any specificity which ones he used during certain time periods. It's like the Madonna case said, where since he can't identify whether he was using the asbestos product or the non-asbestos product, a jury would be speculating if they had to decide this. So that's what Judge Herndon said. He didn't say there wasn't any proof of any exposure. He admitted there was enough evidence. If the only issue was, could there have been exposure to a defendant's product, that yes, there was they had proved a question of fact to that. But that's not the only question here. The question is, was it the product that contained asbestos? And it was enough of an exposure so that you could say that there was legal causation. And that's where the frequency, regularity, proximity issue comes up. Now, they say we didn't raise this issue. But clearly we did. We rely on Rutherford. And frequency, regularity, intensity, whether there were other causes, are all factors under Rutherford. Even though Lorman uses just frequency, regularity, and proximity, there are, you know, this court likes non-exhaustive lists of factors to consider. And there are a number of factors you need to consider to show, to analyze whether there is enough exposure to an asbestos-containing product from these three defendants.
Mr. Pulsberg, once you get past the threshold, though, why isn't frequency, proximity, and regularity questions of fact for the jury? Why aren't those three? Those would be beautiful. It would be great jury instruction. Could be great argument by you and by a plaintiff's attorney in these before a jury. Why aren't they jury questions?
Because there's no evidence here that would tell us what the frequency, regularity. They claim that they can show proximity because he says he worked right with them. Let's put that one aside for the moment. But we don't know which products he worked with. We don't know what time periods to know which products they worked with. We don't know how much he worked with products. Judge Herndon said it's not enough that he was working as a construction worker in Florida, because that he wasn't doing exclusively drywalls, although that's what they alleged in their complaint. He says, look, Mr. Hallman was working on grading, he was doing footers, he was doing framing, he was doing roofing, he was doing everything, and there's nothing there to say how much work he was doing, first, on sheetrock, secondly, with these particular products, and third, whether the products contained asbestos. Remember, Judge Herndon raises the question whether there were 10 different manufacturers at page 2643, because Mr. Hallman admits there were a lot of different manufacturers. He's accustomed during the general time period, the entire six-year time period, to these four, but he cannot say with any type of specificity whether he was using those products frequently or regularly. And plaintiffs even admit that a one-time exposure would not be a substantial factor. That's in the transcript in front of Judge Herndon at page 2535. So the question here is, what's the test for legal cause? You have to show enough exposure, threshold exposure. And there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that would allow that case to go to the jury. And this is not an issue that we've waived. And this is not an issue where their argument that each and every exposure is moot. Yes, they have argued. I say each and every exposure as shorthand. Their argument is that each and every exposure beyond background levels, beyond ambient air levels of asbestos would be a cause. But that's been roundly rejected by courts. And they come in here, remember, I don't have a problem with Dr. Hallman's testimony if you consider what he's saying and what he isn't saying. He nowhere there says that these products, these three defendants' products, were a substantial factor. He says all of the exposures. Remember, we're dealing with a relatively short time period where he was working in construction or in maintenance at Motel 6. During that same time period, he was still working as a mechanic. And for a longer time period, 20 years after the exposure to joint compounds, he's working as a mechanic. There, Judge Herndon said there was an adequate showing to make a prima facie case of causation, because he was able to show what he worked on. and who worked on those products for an even longer time period. So, and that is another factor to consider under Rutherford, whether there are alternative causes. So, no, they can't come in here with just each and every exposure. We're fighting over whether there are two prongs or three prongs. Let me read you a paragraph from the Rutherford case, the case that everybody has cited. And I don't like to read during arguments, but this one time I will. The court says, finally, at a level of abstraction, somewhere between the historical question of exposure and the unknown biology of carcinogenesis, the question arises, and here's the question, whether the risk of cancer created by plaintiff's exposure to a particular asbestos-containing product was significant enough to be considered a legal cause of the disease. How many prongs you get into on this? We're still dealing with the question, did they show enough exposure? Honestly vague, yes. Mr. Holcomb couldn't say how much exposure he had to these three defendants' products versus other products, whether the products contained asbestos or not. There just isn't a case here. You know, there's an axiom in toxicology that dose makes the poison. You can take arsenic or alcohol or even water, and at low doses, they can be innocuous or medicinal or even healthful. And at higher doses, all three of them can be lethal. What is the dose involved here? We have no idea. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Gregg, in many cases after that, said that, you know, if you add a bucket full of water to the ocean, you cannot say that that one bucket was a substantial cause in the depth of the ocean. And that's what we have here. We don't know the dose. We don't know the amount of exposure that was involved here. And so we cannot say that it is a substantial factor. Now, I'm not arguing a geographic defense for Kelly Moore and saying that they didn't. Honestly, I don't think we proved that there isn't a question of fact about whether Kelly Moore sold product in Las Vegas. But it does appear they never sold product in Florida. I'm not raising a geographical defense. I'm raising the fact that when we asked Mr. Holcomb about that, would you be surprised to know that Kelly Moore didn't sell in Florida? He said, no, I'm not surprised. I'm not telling you what I actually used. I'm telling you what I was accustomed to using. The same thing with Bondex. Did you use it in the period before 1978? I don't know what I used. He was candid. Judge Herndon said, we cannot just look at the questions that plaintiff's counsel asked on direct and said, what did you use in Florida? We have to look at the answers, where he never said what he used in Florida. He said generally what he was accustomed to using. And so they really made no case on that. If there are no further questions, let me summarize by saying I think the one standard that we're looking at here is can they prove a prima facie case of causation by showing a threshold level of exposure to each one of these products. An asbestos-containing product, not the non-asbestos product that was made by the same defendants, to show that there is substantial factor in the contribution of the decedent's disease. And that's not a medical causation issue. Now, if they put forward medical proof, the medical proof would have to be to a reasonable degree of medical probability under Hallmark and Higgs and Williams. But that doesn't take it away from being an issue of legal causation. And in this case, for these three joint compound defendants and for Union Carbide, who allegedly supplied product to them, they haven't made the case. They've made the case as to many other defendants. Seven defendants are still in the district court, and the case has been made against them. But especially in light of the proof of the exposure to those products, you cannot say there's a case of legal causation. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Bolesberg, thank you. Mr. Cook, I'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Good. Thank you.
Very quickly, the first thing I want to bring up is Respondent alleges that we don't know the specific product. Well, let me give you an example that we do know the specific product. Mr. Holcomb testified to Kwikset joint compound, PACO Kwikset joint compound. That's a joint compound manufactured by Kelly Moore. At page, the seventh volume, page 1534, Kwikset joint compound is listed as a product manufactured by Kelly Moore. It contained asbestos from 1963 to 1978. That's their interrogatory. That was identified by Mr. Holcomb. So we do have identification of a specific product. With respect to the other products, we have identification of joint compounds manufactured by those companies, and we have asbestos content of all of those joint compounds during certain time frames, and then we have the testimony matching up to those time frames. That's the identification of the product. And I want to observe, very importantly, that quantification is not the test. We don't need to know the exact dose. And you can look to Rutherford for this, too, in a number of other cases, but it's in Rutherford. There's a lot of stuff there. One of the things that Rutherford says is the fact that we don't know the exact dose, we don't know a precise number of fibers that came from the defendant's product and lodged in the plaintiff's lungs, that's not a ground for no liability. There is liability. The defendant can apportion damages to others based on that, but it's not a ground to say you have no liability if we can't specify the dose. So I wanted to make that point. And then with respect to Union Carbide, we haven't addressed Union Carbide. I just want to make clear I'm not folding on Carbide. It's been fully addressed in the briefs. I think the court can go to the briefs to answer those issues. Primarily, I don't even think the court needs to get there because the district court never reached Union Carbide because the ruling was there's no exposure to the joint compounds, ergo no exposure on the Union Carbide aspect of the fiber supply. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
The court thanks Mr. Cliff, Mr. Polsenberg, for your arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted.